like to invite you to listen to The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner, as she looks into the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. The Joyner Report can be heard every Friday evening at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system. Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Hi, and welcome to the Friday night broadcast of the Joyner Report at UFO Paranormal Radio Network.com and at WPRN FM New Orleans. Welcome to all those in gathering in the chat room. I'm always happy to see you there. I have lots of regulars that come back every Friday night, and I really appreciate you guys. Tonight's show features two distinguished guests. First, Captain Robert Salas, and he goes by Bob, I believe. He graduated from the Air Force Academy and spent 7 years in active duty from 1964 to 1971. He also held positions at Martin Marietta and Rockwell and spent 21 years at the FAA. In the Air Force, he was an air traffic controller and a missile launch officer, as well as an engineer on the Titan III missiles. He's testified about a UFO incident on the morning of March 16, 1967, where nuclear missiles simultaneously became non-operational, or what's called a no-go, at two different launch facilities immediately after guards saw UFOs hovering above. It's quite an intriguing story. Welcome to the Joyner Report, Bob.
Great to be with you, Angela. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure. And my second guest is Robert Hastings, who ventured into the lecture circuit after interviewing more than 100 former and retired U.S. Air Force personnel with firsthand experience about UFOs. He has spoken at more than 500 universities and colleges, and I'm sorry to say that he was at Tarleton State University in Stephenville, and I missed it. His first degree is from Ohio University in photography, but in the mid-1980s, he retrained in electron microscopy and also received a certificate in material science applications. He was employed by Philips Semiconductors as a laboratory analyst while continuing to educate others about UFOs in his spare time. His book, UFOs and Nukes, can be found at ufohastings.com. And it's an incredible book. I haven't read all of it. I have read parts of it that answers a lot of questions. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate your having me back on.
Sure. It's great to have you both here. And you contacted me, and you guys have been talking about doing a press conference in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club. I think it's scheduled to be September the 27th. And Robert, can you tell us why you guys want to do this?
Bob and I believe that the American people and people everywhere deserve the facts regarding UFO incursions at nuclear weapons sites, declassified government documents, and the testimony of over 120 people that I've interviewed, not to mention ex-military people that other researchers have interviewed, clearly confirm the existence of ongoing UFO activity at nuclear missile sites, nuclear weapons storage areas, nuclear test sites, and so forth. And it's quite clear to us, to Bob and myself, that this is a tremendously important subject. We have gathered together at this point about seven other individuals, former and retired military personnel who were involved in incidents involving UFOs and nuclear weapons, And the purpose of the press conference is to present our case. These highly vetted, quite credible people are going to tell their stories for the assembled media, and we're hoping to get as wide as possible exposure for the reality of all of this as possible.
Bob, can you tell us the witnesses you have in mind to appear there?
Well, you know, we don't want to release those names just yet. I think we can release a couple if it's all right with Robert. Colonel Charles Holt would be one of them. He's agreed to do it. We're collecting affidavits right now, and once we've got those affidavits in hand, and these are, you know, signed by the witnesses telling their stories, then I think we'll start publicizing who these witnesses are and tell a little bit more about it so we can get the media involved.
Right. And so you are collecting affidavits at this time, and until you get those, you don't want to release the names?
That's right.
Okay. And I know that something like this takes quite a bit of dough to get everybody there and cover expenses and all that. How much have you raised so far?
That's right. I don't know, we've raised about $2,000, but it looks like we're going to need closer to $10,000 or $15,000 to really do a decent job, make this happen. That's why we're still asking for donations. You can go to Robert Hastings' website, UFOHastings.com, and it'll instruct you how to donate there. We'll accept anything. Dollars, bills, anything, bottle caps. We still need to follow through and get more donations to make this happen. So if any of your listeners can contribute, we'd be grateful. And any excess money that we collect will be donated to charity.
That's nice. Well, yeah. Leslie Keene and James Fox did something similar at the National Press Club. Do you think that having these guys on will make a difference, Robert? Do you think that that's going to be what it will take to for disclosure, or what?
My effort goes back to 1981. I've been speaking about this publicly at colleges and universities since 1981. These things take time. There is a resistance, obviously, on the part of the government in being honest with the American people. There's also a resistance in public opinion and perception about UFOs that has to be slowly altered, and people need to be enlightened about the reality and the importance of all. So I know it's a long haul, and I view it as a situation where if water drips on stone long enough, stone will wear away. And the people who are going to be at the press club, are getting on in years, as we all are, and these people's voices need to be heard. This is something that we need to do without any further delay. We have to rely on the sensibilities and the, perceptions of the media to realize and accept the importance of this. These sources, these people, including Bob Salas, weren't vetted by the U.S. government. They were entrusted with weapons of mass destruction. If we had gone to war with the Soviets, these gentlemen would have launched weapons, and that would have altered the history of the human race. So these are very credible people. They were entrusted in these very responsible positions. And over 120 of them that I've interviewed, let alone other researchers, have now come forward and said that UFOs have monitored nuclear weapons, including missile sites, for decades. And on occasion, and Bob can discuss his case in detail, and there are many others, but on occasion, when these saucer-shaped objects were above the missiles malfunctioned. In one case, they even activated. And, we can get into some of those cases at length. And this has gone on not only in the U.S., but in the former Soviet Union. And we can discuss that. So this is tremendously important. I have had thousands and thousands of emails from people over the years especially after Bob and my appearance on Larry King, people expressing support for what we're doing and, you know, urging us to continue our work. So I'm asking those people just to help us out. We need money to get this event off the ground. There's no two ways about it. And, you know, I appreciate everyone's support, but we're in a position where we need financial support to fly people to Washington, to put them up, to allow this event to go forward.
It's kind of hard to do in this economy, I know. Bob, I am somewhat familiar with your experience in the late 60s, but why don't you tell us about that and what happened that morning in March?
Okay, real good. First of all, I want to kind of set the stage. I was a missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base from 66 to 69, and what that means is we had control of 10 nuclear missiles. We'd go out on alert duty about every 3 days. We'd go out to the site, which was located out in wheat fields in Montana, and we'd go down in an elevator, down about 60 feet underground. We had a large concrete capsule full of electronic gear, computers, and such, and all the control systems were down there for the weapons. 10 nuclear missiles at what we called launch facilities were located in a kind of a ring around this launch control center, and we had about 4 to 6 guards upstairs, something like that. So on this particular morning, in my case, I was at Oscar flight, and on March 24th, we've been able to narrow down the date to March 24th, 1967. I gave a call initially, and it was sometime in the evening. It was dark. I don't recall the exact time. My flight security controller or main guard calls down and says that they've been seeing some strange lights in the sky, making real odd maneuvers, flying very rapidly, stopping on a dime and reversing direction, that sort of thing. I think I even said, "You mean like UFO?" And kind of chuckled because I didn't believe in UFOs at the time. I had no idea what the heck those were.
Did you think he would? Did you feel you might be pulling your leg?
Yeah, that thought occurred to me. Although, these guys were really professionals. And, of course, because we all knew what we had to protect there. We had nuclear weapons. And this was a very professional group, like I said. And although I did find it strange, I didn't pay too much attention to that call. And I kind of dismissed it. And then about 5 minutes later, he calls back, and this time he's screaming into the phone and very, very scared, frightened. And he said, "Sir, I'm looking out the window here at the front gate, and there's a glowing red object, oval-shaped, pulsating red, and it's just hovering right outside the front gate, above the gate." And he had all his guards out there with their weapons drawn. He wanted me to tell him what to do next. I think I said something like, "Gee, make sure nothing comes inside the fence." I ended that call. He did say one of the guards got injured, although it was a minor hand injury. I think he was injured because he was so frightened. He cut his hand on the fence there. But he hung up the phone. I went over to tell my commander, Fred Maiwald, who, by the way, is alive and well, living in Las Vegas. He's supported my statements many times, and so he's another live witness to this. So I started to tell him about the phone calls, and I didn't finish my first sentence before the missile started to go into what we called a no-go condition. it went from green lights to red lights. We got a lot of bells and whistles on the control panel. And I recall that all 10 of the missiles went down. In other words, they couldn't be used. They couldn't be launched. They were, while this object was still above the launch control facility. Of course, we couldn't leave the facility to underground to go up and take a look because we're obligated to stay locked in there until we get relieved the next day. Our procedures, Fred Mywald turns to me and says, the same thing happened at another site. I recall those words vividly. And this was after talking to command post back in Great Falls. We were about 100 miles from Great Falls. These facilities are scattered around Montana. And then we also had security-like incursions. In other words, we had indicators to make sure that nothing intruded into the area where the missiles were actually located. And so I had to call back up and talk to the guard again and send security teams out to the launch those launch facilities that had security lights. And while they were out there, they reported seeing the objects, object or objects again. And so we got those reports, and Fred Mywald has confirmed that. So that's basically the incident. There's more that followed up, you know, the aftermath, but that's basically it.
Well, what was the what were emotions like? I mean, was it everybody like in a panic trying to figure out what was going on? I mean, you're seeing these missiles went down one at a time, right? And you're seeing that happen, and it's your job not to let that happen. What was he doing? What was the atmosphere like?
Well, I can tell you from one of the witnesses that'll be in Washington with us is Robert Jameson, and he was set out to restart those missiles, bring them back up online, and he was telling us that it was kind of panic back at the base. You know, they were bringing in all the crews, everybody was standing by, they were getting briefed on UFOs in the vicinity, and so there, it was kind of a crisis situation. After and one of the messages we got from after we did a Freedom of Information Act and got documents on this, Strategic Air Command message said it was of grave concern. They used these words, grave concern, that we didn't know they didn't know what caused the shutdowns. So absolutely, there was a lot of stress around this.
And was there any possibility that it was just some sort of malfunction? I mean, what is the likelihood of, what was it, 16, 10 missiles, whatever the number, would all go off at the same time?
Well, let me just correct you on that. At first, I thought that the other site, which we call Echo Flight, went down the same day. Because of, I remember the comment from Fred Mywald. He turned to me and said the same thing happened at another site. But what I guess he should have said was the same, command post told him the same thing happened a week earlier at another site. And that's what we finally discovered, that a week earlier, Echo Flight went down under similar circumstances. Had UFOs hovering over the launch facilities themselves. And they lost all 10 of their missiles. And I'd say we lost all 20 of those missiles within a period of a week, and all due to UFO activity.
Well, what would be the likelihood of there just being some sort of malfunction that caused them to go down? I mean, how do you know for sure it was the UFO?
Well, this is very unlikely. It was rare. I was there for 3 years on alert status, on alert duty, and it was very rare for any of the missiles to go down for any reason. For example, a misconception people have talked about is that, well, you lost power, but we didn't lose power. In my incident or the Echo incident, there was no power loss per se. We had power throughout these missiles went down for a specific reason. We got guidance and control system failure on the Aquarius system that we had. And so the DACO flight, the same kind of failure. They interrupted, somehow disrupted the either guidance system or the targeting system for the missiles. What are the chances these missiles are independent? You know, they had independent lines going to each of them. The lines were buried 60 feet underground. They were triple protected, shielded cables. So this was a phenomenal thing. Nothing like that ever happened in my 3 years while I was there, not even close.
Well, it's my understanding they weren't down for just a few minutes. They were down for several hours and were down when you went off duty that way. Is that correct?
That's right. I think they were down for an entire day, just about. Yeah, we had to send crews out there to each site, each missile, and realign and retarget each missile. So that took time.
Okay.
And,
so,
Angela, if I can interject, I think it's important to elaborate on. Bob brought up Robert Jameson, who was a targeting officer, not a launch officer like Bob, but I interviewed Bob Jameson even before Bob Salas went public, and Jameson was telling me about responding to a full flight shutdown of 10 missiles going offline, and said that when he arrived at the missile maintenance hangar, the place was just in an uproar. As soon as he walked in the door, he heard from people, other targeting team members, that there was a UFO involvement in the shutdowns. He didn't quite understand what that was all about, but the rumors were that unidentified flying objects were sighted at the missiles' positions just before the failures. He ultimately was briefed, and his briefers, the official missile maintenance squadron briefers, told them point blank, according to Bob Jameson, that there was definitely a UFO involvement in the shutdown of the missiles, and in fact, they were not going to be allowed into the field to drive out this 100-plus miles to the missile sites to repair them, to bring them back online and retarget them until all reports of UFO activity had ceased from the field. Further, they were given instructions that if they saw a UFO on the way to the missiles, they were instructed to immediately call the base command post and report it. If they were already working on the missiles at the sites, trying to bring them back online and saw a UFO, Jameson said that his targeting team and all the other assembled targeting teams were told point blank that they were to immediately get into what's called the personnel access hatch, go underground. If a UFO approached the missile site, leading only the guard, the security guard that accompanied each team, out to the site above ground with a radio so we could report back to the base what the UFO was doing. So there was no question whatsoever that there was not any normal or routine type of malfunction involved. The people who were charged with bringing the missiles back up were told point blank that the UFOs had shut them down. The way Jameson put it, I tape all my interviews, and the way he put it was they told us that UFOs were messing things up, and then he elaborated on all the other things that I just mentioned. Now, while they were waiting, at the hangar to go out into the field and were being held back, there was a temporary command post set up, and Jameson said he was listening on a wing radio between, he couldn't remember if it was the base commander or the wing commander at the hangar, who was talking to Air Force personnel out at another site near a canyon near Great Falls, near a little town called Belt, where a UFO had landed. And in effect was being cordoned off the area. There was security personnel, but this object was in the base of the canyon, on the floor of the canyon. And what he was hearing over this two-way radio while he was waiting to go into the field was that when daylight came, they were going to send helicopters down to try to locate it. Now, that is known as the Belt Canyon UFO incident. And because there have been some civilian witnesses to this event, and even some a state policeman was aware of this going on. All of this hit the papers and was in the Great Falls newspapers the next day. So we know that it was March 24th, which is one of the indicators that we can pinpoint this evening event that we think Bob Salas was involved in at Oscar flight. Everything that Jameson says, the timing of day, the other events points to this being the same incident that Bob was involved in.
All right. Well, how long was the UFO there? I mean, how long did the guys observe the UFO that glowed a red color above the gate?
I'd say not very long. Like I said, the guard called down, he told us about the UFO, hung up. I went over to talk to my commander. The missiles went down. This was within minutes of that last call, and the missiles went down quickly, one right after the other, you know, within seconds of each other. And then, of course, since I had the security violations at the launch facilities, I had to call back up. And by the time I called back up, the UFO had gone. So, but the UFO was up there during this time period when the missiles went down. Now, I want to emphasize that the upstairs people had no control over, in any way, over the missiles. They didn't have any controls up there, so they couldn't have instituted some kind of a hoax, as a joke. This was not a joke.
Well, and did they describe the manner in which the UFO left? Did it just disappear? Did it take off at lightning speed, or do you know?
Yeah, the latter. As I recall, the guard said it just took off, but, you know, it just instantly took off.
So it was there only a few minutes and managed to knock out these missiles, but really, very, really quickly.
Exactly, yes.
And as you look back, Bob, and you think about that, do you dream about it at night? Does it bother you, or is it just something that happened? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I can tell you that for a long time, you know, this is after I went public. That's another story. But for a long time, I thought about this, and it was more mechanical, you know, thinking of the facts, et cetera. I didn't have any nightmares over it, but it's been only within the last few years that this really hit home, that this was really something phenomenal that, struck a very deep chord. And I've been kind of obsessed with this whole thing with, you know, telling this story and informing the public. So it's kind of an obsession with me now. I've tried to get away from this many times. You know, it's been 15 years since I've gone public. I keep getting drawn back in and people wanting to hear this story.
Well, you know, I've only been in this field for a couple of years, and already in the last couple of months especially, I thought, why am I doing this? I don't know if, you know, it's ever going to accomplish any purpose or anything. And I thought, well, could I leave it if I wanted to, if I decide that I want to get out of this? I think it might be like a bear caught in a trap. You may have to chew off your own foot to get out. I don't know how it's going to work.
That's a good way to put it.
But
I said earlier, you know, I've been interviewing people like Bob since 1973, and by 1981 I felt that I had enough information to go public on the college lecture circuit. So I've been doing this for closing in on four decades. And when I was younger, and I believe that, you know, certainly within 10 years this would all be out in the open, you know, Washington would have to come clean. But I just turned 60, and I'm now thinking that, you know, I may not live to see the big announcement. But, you know, the thing people have to remember is paradigm shifts take time more often than not. You know, the scientists ignore this and laugh at it. The journalists, for the most part, ignore this and laugh at this. traditionally religious people, with all due respect to their beliefs, think this is all either nonsense or the work of the devil or whatever. And so there's this resistance in terms of government secrecy, coupled with public perception, coupled with traditional religious beliefs. There's a lot of doors that have to be, you know, knocked down or opened forcefully before the you know, collective weight of public opinion is at the point where, you know, the government will have no choice but to talk about this. So people who think that, you know, people who are interested in this and want the facts to come out, I can tell you from experience, you know, be patient, because this is, you know, you've got to be in this for the long haul. But
yeah,
the reason it's worth the wait, because this is so tremendously important. I think Bob and I agree, and many of my witnesses, ex-military people agree, we are dealing with beings from another world who have a technology vastly superior to human technology. And whatever else they're doing here on Earth, whatever other operation or game plan they have, one thing they are definitely doing is monitoring and occasionally tampering with our nuclear weapons, not only here but in Russia. And we can talk about that later, but it's going on, and obviously this is tremendously important. You know, this planet almost went to nuclear Armageddon more than once in the last 40 years, and it appears that outside observers have been taking this all in and been closely monitoring the situation. And if that's not a front page story, I don't know what is. Hello.
Hello. I think we got cut off.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
covered on.
I guess so.
All right, guys, I think they can hear you now.
Okay, are we on?
You're on.
Okay.
We're
I'm
all
sorry.
On.
We've had some technical difficulties here. I'm talking with Robert Hastings and Bob Salas. This is the Joyner Report, and it seems that
have a premiere showing of a new UFO documentary. It's called UFO, The Greatest Story Ever Denied, and it's going to be shown tomorrow here in Ojai. I'm in Ojai, California, at the local theater at 4:30 p.m. If anybody is close by and wants to come and see it, it's an excellent documentary, and the producer, Jose Escamilla, will be there. I just want to announce that. And the proceeds from that will go for our press conference, will be held in Washington, D.C. Did you get that, Angela?
This is Robert. I can hear you, Bob. Angela, Joe?
Looks like they're gone.
Sounds like we're having some...
I can hear you now.
Now I can. Why don't we just plan on rescheduling like she suggested, and you guys need to talk this up and get some buzz going. There have been legitimate telephone problems that I've had over the years, and so we can talk about that on the next show. Well, we need
okay, I'll still be here all night if she wants to call us back. So I'll be here.
Sir, thank you all. Good luck tomorrow, Bob.
What's that? Right. Okay. I'm signing off.